Hello.
Hi.
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 Hello.
I'm curious about
building open, authentic, loving relationship.
I'm curious about jealousy.
I'm curious about polyamory.
Does it just mean that you're fucking all the time?
How can I tell my parents that my partner is already married?
I'm curious about...
How do you know when you're too busy to have another relationship?
I'm curious about dominant and subordinate relationships.
I'm curious about sexual health.
How can relationships evolve with people as they grow and change?
We're not just our temperament or one personality trait, right? We are... I mean, everyone knows it is all so complex and complicated what shapes us.
Welcome to the Curious Folks podcast for those who challenge the status quo in love, sex, and relationships. My name is Effie Blue. Today, I am curious about highly sensitive men, how high sensitivity differs for those socialized as men, and how this quality, especially in men, affects relationships. To help me explore this topic, I'm joined by the man who wrote the book on it.
Hi, my name is Tom Falkenstein. I'm a cognitive behavioral psychotherapist and psychologist, and I'm the author of the book, The Highly Sensitive Men.
Before we dive into this topic, it's time for some audience participation. We have three fun, quick, and easy ways for you to be involved with Jacqueline, me, and the podcast, and help us challenge the status quo in love, sex, and relationships. Back in episode 89, for Halloween of yesteryears, we had fun turning our relationship fears into rooms of a haunted house of relationship horrors. For example, my fear of getting stuck in a relationship escalator without any power to shape my own destiny turned into a room where, upon entering, you stepped into a Stairmaster-style contraption with the exit door at the top. Your attempts to get out just kept you on the Stairmaster with no joy, no design, just drudgery of social compliance and misery. Scary even thinking about it now. This year, for Halloween, we want to open the haunted house once again, but this time with rooms from you. So, here is the invitation. Jump onto episode 89 if you haven't heard it already or need a refresher, and then get creative. Pick that one fear that you have when it comes to love, sex, or relationship, and see if you can design your room that represents it. Once you're done, get your voice memo app on your phone and tell us all about it. Then send it to listening@wearecuriousfoxes.com. You don't need to include your name if you don't want to.
Next, in my 4.5 minutes of spare time, I opened an Etsy shop. It's a place for me to create products that I want to wear and use, from bags for femme lesbians and bisexuals who want to make it very clear that we are not just allies, to shirts that declare that I'm with him and her, to tote bags that proclaim that I've got 99 problems and white, hetero, mononormative patriarchy is basically all of them. The Etsy shop is filled with fun pieces, each designed to help us challenge the status quo and celebrate the beauty of pride. Use code PODCAST to get 10% off through the end of July. And if you're in the US, get free shipping straight to your door. Visit the Roots and Wings Gallery on Etsy or find the link in our show notes or in my Instagram bio.
Finally, one huge way you can support the podcast is by connecting with the show on your fave podcast app. This can be a heart, favorite, or a follow button. Also, rating the show and leaving a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We don't have any advertisers or sponsors, so we rely on our community of listeners to spread the word. If you enjoy the show, or if any of the episodes have meant something to you, write a quick review as soon as the episode is over.
And remember that the best way to stay in contact with us is via our newsletter, where you'll get new episode drop emails, monthly digest, and themed emails, where we curate and share all of our episodes about opening up, jealousy, sex, and more. Jump onto our website, wearecuriousfoxes.com, and sign up to the newsletter. And while you're there, check out our blog posts, resources, reading list recommendations, and so much more.
And we're back. The world got to know the highly sensitive person through the work of the clinical research psychologist and author, Elaine Aron. Originally published in 1996, her bestseller book, The Highly Sensitive Person, not only entered the term highly sensitive person, or HSP, into common vernacular, It also helped many people who fit this criteria make sense of the world and their unique experience in it. In 2019, in his book, The Highly Sensitive Man, cognitive behavioral psychotherapist Tom Falkenstein focused on high sensitivity specifically in men. When Tom and I sat down to talk about this, I wanted to start by understanding what exactly is a highly sensitive person.
It's initially an old concept from that Jung already mentioned. He called it innate sensitiveness, and he mentioned it in 1913, saying that about 25% of the population is more sensitive than the rest. And what Elaine Aron did in the 90s is she started researching that innate sensitivity and called it sensory processing sensitivity, which is the term research, or a high sensitivity, or the highly sensitive person, how it's known outside academia. And what it basically describes, the concept, is a temperamental trait or personality trait. And the way I try to describe it normally is that I say everyone is sensitive, we're all sensitive, but there are individual differences in our sensitivity. So there are individual differences in how we process and respond to information. And some of us are more sensitive than others due to a more sensitive central nervous system. And what the research since the 90s has shown is that about 30% of the population is particularly sensitive in terms of they process things very deeply and more than the rest. And about 40% are in the medium range of sensitivity, and about 30% are low in sensitivity. And Elaine Aron then basically describes four characteristics that describe being highly sensitive. And those four, she often shortens it with the acronym DOES, 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 mm-hmm. And D is for depth of processing. So that what I just mentioned, that sort of deep processing, cognitive processing of emotional, physical, social stimuli. Mm. O is for overstimulation, so a tendency to feel very quickly overstimulated, which makes sense if you think about if you see a lot and process a lot and think a lot about what you're experiencing, that you then also become probably quite quickly overstimulated, and that is what O describes. E is for emotional reactivity, including empathy, so the idea that people who are highly sensitive are particularly emotional, and that means not just negative emotions and in inverted commas, negative and positive emotions, but the whole spectrum of emotions. So they feel joy and positive feelings quite strongly, but also, if you want to call them negative feelings, quite strongly. Mm-hmm. And S is for DOES, S is for sensitivity to subtle stimuli. So being quite sensitive to physical subtle stimuli, like let's say lights or certain scents or certain fabric you don't like to wear. And that is basically what describes a highly sensitive person in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super interesting. Definitely relate to a lot of that myself.
Yeah.
I'm curious, do we know if highly sensitive people are born that way or are they made? Do we know? Or is it one of those like nature nurture questions?
Yeah. Yes, it is a little bit. I know that Elaine Aron in the 90s had very much the opinion that it's an innate trait. Mm. But obviously, you know, it's always a mixture of environment and genes. And there's a study that's been done recently that basically showed it's sort of 50-50, I think 51% nature and the other one is nurture.
Mm. Fascinating. Yeah. So I know that whenever I have sort of talked about highly sensitive people and when the conversation comes up, it's often, for some reason, more easily spoken about in terms of women, right?
Yes, yes.
You wrote a book that's specifically around highly sensitive men, which I think is really important to look at it that way. How does high sensitivity differ between people who are socialized as men or socialized as women?
So let me just maybe quickly describe why I wrote this book, and maybe that will in a way also then answer your question, because exactly for what you just mentioned, that was exactly the one of the reasons why I decided to write the book. So I'm, as I mentioned in the introduction, I'm a psychotherapist, and I've been working as a psychotherapist now for 12 years. And I used to work and live in London at a clinic, and I happened to have a lot of young men who all mentioned in their sessions that they were that they struggled being particularly sensitive and emotional. And it wasn't a sensitivity or an emotionality linked to their mental health issues they were treated for at the time. It was more sensitivity and a sense of being quite emotional that they had experienced since they were children. And that really made me think about sensitivity for the first time. This was about 10 years ago, probably. And then I remember thinking, oh, I should do some research on sensitivity and maybe I can discuss it with them or show them, you know, why it's not so bad to be sensitive as a man or emotional as a man. And I remember going to a bookshop in London, and it was a big bookshop, and there were books on sensitivity, high sensitivity, but they were all written by women, and they seemingly were written for women. And the highly sensitive men was only mentioned very briefly in all these books, usually like a page or. And I just felt it doesn't really reflect what I'm seeing on the bookshelf. Just doesn't reflect what I'm experiencing in the consulting room. And that made me think about how is it that we don't talk about high sensitivity in men? Clearly it exists, but it does come up in therapy sessions. And I then basically started, you know, doing research, and I got in touch with Elaine Aaron, who I just mentioned, and we started having supervision, and I did some training with her, and interviewed her for the book, basically, and then interviewed highly sensitive men, because I wanted to get a good understanding of what they're struggling with. And I then basically ended up interviewing 25 highly sensitive men, and I included 9 of those interviews in the book. And basically, when I had interviewed everyone, I just sort of tried to work out, are there any sort of common themes that emerge? So by looking at those interviews, is there something that they mention again and again and again? And is this somehow different from what maybe highly sensitive women might struggle with and what I had read in those books that I mentioned? And then I basically arranged it sort of in sort of 3 areas that are particularly challenging or that have been mentioned again and again and again in those interviews. And there seemed to be one topic that emerged, and that was working with feeling, well, working around emotion regulation and overstimulation, because that is something a lot of high sensitive men struggle with. Not everyone, of course. It's not a homogenous group. You know, I think that's something to remember. Not every highly sensitive man is, you know, a soft-spoken artist. Mm-hmm. But there seemed to have been, what I noticed was there was a theme of around emotionality and working with around overstimulation. And then the other area that I noticed was issues around self-care. So living a lifestyle that is not particularly suitable to your temperament. And the third issue area that a lot of men struggled with was the topic of being very self-critical. And I wonder, due to being very sensitive and being very emotional, and I think when you ask me about the differences between what is different maybe between someone who identifies as male or female from as highly sensitive, I wonder whether this part is different, that also highly sensitive women have to deal with overstimulation and dealing with emotional regulation, and they might also live a lifestyle that isn't particularly suitable to their sensitive disposition. But I do wonder whether for many, not for all of them, but for many highly sensitive men, the third aspect, the problem around self-criticism and the sense that you're not quite living up to the male ideal, is somehow more problematic because it just adds a layer to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't fit into the narrative of what we expect from masculinity. So I can totally understand
exactly
how it would cause sort of internal dissonance, right? It's in an additional layer.
Yeah.
Whereas for women, we talk about the feminine spirit and the gentleness and kindness and softness,
yeah,
and sensitivity,
yeah,
are all kind of,
yeah,
already words that we use within the feminine sort of characteristics, right? But we don't use those,
yes,
for the masculine,
exactly,
characteristics. So I can see how it would cause definitely an extra layer of dissonance for men. And not finding any resources, and only resources they find is 90% about women and, you know, a footnote about men. And I can see how that exacerbates,
yes,
the situation as well. So
Completely. And I think if we do use those descriptions or those attributes for men, it's usually shaming, or it causes shame in a lot of men, you know. And I think that that is something that I think a highly sensitive men, and again, when I interviewed those 25 men, not everyone experienced that. There were some highly sensitive men who said, oh, you know, it was always fine being quite thoughtful. It was fine growing up. It was fine being very reflective. It was liked by my parents that I was emotional, or by peers. But there were also many who had a different story to tell. And I just wanted to include that in the book.
Mm. And what are some of those other stories? Because I'm wondering whether there is the high, I mean, here is sort of the way that I imagine. There's the high sensitivity, right? Like how you are processing that information. Mm-hmm. And then there is your reaction to it. Which are, I think, two separate states. You can be highly sensitive and get overstimulated. And what you do with that overstimulation, I imagine, differs from person to person. Some might shut down and go inwards, and some might just like push out sort of to release that energy. Yeah. And I can see how, you know, if you're socialized as a woman, you're more likely to sort of hold it in or collapse. Whereas men, I can see how that can turn into aggression, which sounds counterintuitive on paper, but not at the same time.
Yes, I think that's a really interesting point that you're mentioning here. So sometimes, you know, I think if you grow up with the sense that it's expected or more okay to go outwards, then you might exactly show a certain kind of behavior, let's say aggression or anger, or just verbalizing it more, going more outwards rather than inwards. And I think that's what often happens with men, that there's a certain outward, you know, behavior that makes you not see almost what's behind it. So I think that's why, for example, I mean, this is not just the case for highly sensitive people or highly sensitive men, but when we, you know, I think it's when we deal with anger management or you know, working on anger, full stop, or on self-destructive behavior, I think it is really important to explore what's underneath it, obviously, and what other feelings there are that, you know, might come out as anger, but usually anger, you know, there's another feeling underneath, and that could be a much more vulnerable feeling. But yes, I think there are, again, it's different, I don't want to generalize too much, but I think there are differences often between men and women that we can see.
Mm. Again, on this note, is it also fair to say that we sometimes mischaracterize this idea of being highly sensitive with being also soft and gentle and sort of kind, and but it could actually kind of look like aggression and harshness because of the emotional dysregulation.
Exactly. I remember I once had a client who, and it's also being mentioned in the book, you know, who seemed very, you know, masculine in the traditional sense, let's say, you know, whatever that, you know, traditional description is of masculinity that we many of us have in our heads and grew up. But he seemed very sort of, you know, very straight and very masculine and very almost macho, I would say, to an extent, very extroverted. And actually, but then that was just how he appeared. And if you scratch the surface a little bit with him in his sessions, then it became obvious that there are obviously much more vulnerable feelings underneath that need to be looked at in therapy, for example.
Mm.
So, yeah, I just felt writing this book, and it's a book that is obviously also for women, you know, I mean, I it was really important to me to write a book that feels very inclusive, and while it is addressing men, I also think it is helpful, is a helpful book for women who want to learn more about maybe the highly sensitive brother or the highly sensitive partner or father or whatever. But also if they're highly sensitive themselves, they might find the second part of the book, which is all tools and techniques. The first part is more theory, and you know, I talk a bit about masculinity and mental health in men, which is really very problematic when you start researching a little bit the figures and the stats when it comes to mental health in men. But so the first part of the book is very much sort of theoretical, and the second part is very practical. And I think, despite it being a book for highly sensitive men, I also get quite a lot of emails from women who've read it and who found it very helpful, either for themselves or for, you know, helping them to understand highly sensitive men in their lives better.
Hmm. I'm curious whether you can speak to a little about how being a highly sensitive man specifically might impact romantic relationships.
So what I, this is just based on my interviews that I did for the book and on my therapeutic work with highly sensitive men. What I noticed is, and again, I don't want to generalize too much, but what I noticed is a certain, so sometimes we have some issues around masculinity in terms of the sense, oh, having grown up with the sense that they're not manly enough. And of course, that can impact on how they later on interact with potential partners, or how they, how much confidence they show when it comes to broaching others. And that is something that has come up quite a lot, not for everyone, but for many. And I noticed also that most of them that I spoke to were either single or they were in more long-term relationships, which I find interesting. So they weren't, no one, maybe they just didn't want to say it because they didn't want to say it, but none of them said, oh yes, I'm having a lot of partners or I'm, you know, I can't quite commit to relationships. So, and I thought about this when I wrote the book, and it didn't matter whether they were gay or straight or, and I was thinking, oh, it's really interesting because maybe it shows that if you are a bit more shy, maybe also a bit more sensitive, and maybe you find certain situations slightly more challenging, but maybe that does mean that you're not constantly seeking new stimulation in terms of, you know, new partners, or maybe you're more likely to stick with what you have, so to speak. But I don't know. These are just my personal thoughts. It's not backed up with anything. This is just based on the interviews that I did. But the pattern was certainly more long-term relationship and not many, many sexual adventures and loads of different partners. So most of the men I spoke to weren't high sensation seekers. You know, they weren't looking for really stimulating, exciting, adventurous, maybe slightly dangerous situations or relationships.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, right? That makes sense. I'm curious whether, does it have a certain impact on partner choice? If you're arriving with high sensitivity, do you know if it has a any kind of impact on partner choice?
I can't think of any research being done on that. I think that would be a really interesting PhD. Maybe the next one, if I do another one, I'll do that. I'm going to choose that topic. But I can't think of any research to back it up. But just based on the interviews that I did, there were, I think, a couple of men who were drawn to partners who they described as narcissistic or emotionally unstable. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, just something that I sort of picked up as I was doing the interviews, that this was mentioned a couple of times. So the combination of someone who is highly sensitive, or in that case, highly sensitive men, and a woman or man, another man who has some traits of narcissism or borderline personality or whatever, you know. And I think that's quite an interesting observation. And I wonder whether that is something that sometimes occurs.
Some of the trends that I see with my coaching, because I work with couples and people in relationships. Again, mm-hmm. No research. There's so many topics that I wanna research. I should go back to school. I feel like I should just be at school for the rest of my life. But
there's still time.
Yes. The thing that I see, and this is why I kind of ask that question: do we know if we're born this way, or, you know, is it nature nurture question, right? And it makes sense that it's 50-50, just like any of these traits.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, some of the things that I see with my clients who show up more sensitive, the way that I talk about it is that if we imagine that we have two antennas, right? One antenna points outwards, and that antenna picks up the people around us and where they are, and allows us to socialize and meet people where they're at and kind of co-regulate to the crowd, right? And then another internal antenna that points inwards, and that is giving us a feedback from within us, right? And that's an ideal situation. So we know how we feel, and that's anything from, am I hungry? Do I need a pee? Do I need water? All the way to, how do I feel? Do I want to be here? Is this within my boundaries? All that kind of stuff, right? So that's an ideal situation. And I think what I have noticed, that if you grow up in households where there was a lot of volatility or a lot of change within the closest caregivers, that we kind of grow up, the one antenna pointing out isn't enough, doesn't feel enough, because there's so much going on and the child brain can't process. Uh-huh. So we end up kind of using the internal antenna. We point it outwards as well. So now we have two antennas, which is making us highly sensitive. right, to the outside mm-hmm. environment, and cuts us off. What I notice a lot, like, cuts us off from ourselves, right? And mm-hmm. I can see how that person is now going out in the world with two antennas pointing outwards, feeling very sensitive and not having the mm-hmm. emotional regulation skills, because they're not getting the feedback they need from, there is no internal yeah. antenna, if you will.
Yeah.
And of course that causes overstimulation. It inhibits self-care, because uh-huh. if you're not getting the feedback, how are you going to take care of yourself? Right. And of course mm-hmm. within that environment, with the volatility and sort of instability, you do also get sort of negative narratives, right? Within that household, you mm-hmm. tend to get the negative narratives. So to me, it kind of like hits all the notes that you shared. And I'm wondering, that yeah. idea kind of then has like a sidestep into attachment and kind of seeking what you know what love looks like, right? So, and then you end up finding partners who mimic or mirror, you know, the disturbed households that you might have developed in. That's kind of how I would connect the dots. I don't know. How does that feel for you?
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. And I think that makes a lot of sense to, you know, that it's quite a good picture, I think, of those two antennas and, you know, and what are the circumstances we grew up in. I think with high sensitivity, it is important to mention that not every highly sensitive person had a negative or particularly volatile upbringing.
Mm.
So, you know, there are loads of people, highly sensitive people out there who had good enough or good childhoods, you know, mm. I mean, however you want to define that. But in terms of, you know, care and safety and feeling loved. So, and they're still highly sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is the only thing I would add, would add to it. But yes, I mean, I think it is very complicated, isn't it? I mean, we're not just our temperament or one personality trait, right? We are, I mean, everyone of us, it is all so complex and complicated what shapes us, you know, and you mentioned attachment styles. You mentioned, you know, if you think about the experiences we have, if you think about personality traits that we grew up with, I mean, all these things form us. And I think it is very complicated to, you know, sometimes I think when we see what I slightly struggle with in the whole conversation around high sensitivity is that it almost seems to become, for some people, the one defining aspect of their character or of their personality. And I think it is, for me, speaking as a clinician, as a therapist, I find it very helpful to, first of all, for myself, to, if I work with patients, to think about it, whether they are also highly sensitive. Of course, they see me for other things often. So sometimes I, you know, people see me who don't know anything about high sensitivity, don't know, hear anything about it. Mm. They see me for mental health issues. And then others see me because they want some advice or some consultations on high sensitivity. But for me as a therapist working with people who are, let's say, depressed or anxious, I think it is just really important. It's just another layer that I find quite helpful when it comes to working with those patients. And at the same time, the other way around, I think when we know whether we're highly sensitive, it just might help us a little bit to understand ourselves better. But I'm always a little bit careful when people then go into the other extreme and say, oh, this is, you know, this is it. This describes everything of me. And no matter my attachment styles or my, you know, whatever I, you know, experienced is all about this one trait. And I think it's just a bit too simplistic, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think it's very complex.
No, it totally makes sense that it is the one piece of the puzzle that is the human. So mm-hmm. that totally makes sense.
But I generally feel that in life, you know, I mean, maybe that's just me, mm-hmm. but I generally feel a bit like, you know, we often as humans, we try to sort of narrow things down to one thing, you know, this is it. And this is who I am, or this is what I, you know, sort of defining ourselves by one thing. And I'm always a bit sort of cautious when people do it or when I see it, because I just feel a bit like, yeah, but it is so multifaceted, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. If you were a speculating man, why would you say that happened? Why do we seek that one label, the one answer, the one facet that we want to lead with?
I sometimes wonder whether it just gives us a slightly false sense of security and simplicity in life. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you really start thinking about life and us, you know, being here and the world, and I mean, I think it is so complicated, and the human condition, I think, is so complicated, and And life is so incredibly fragile that I do sometimes wonder whether it just gives people a sense of security and identity, you know, that this is me, you know. And I just wonder whether some people find it difficult to stay in that between space. And I think there's just for many people a tendency to go into, you know, into self-defining as one thing, because it's maybe less scary, I don't know, or gives you a sense of safety.
Yeah, sure. I think I agree with you. I think that's definitely the simplicity, the ease of it. And I think there is the extra work that is needed to hold the multiplicity in our minds. It can be exhausting, I think, to be able to say this and this and this and not, you know, this or this is kind of, you're making, it's easier to go down that path, I think, just making decisions, you know, in each fork. But I think it's a different way of thinking. And I think it takes up more bandwidth to kind of keep all the multiplicities and see them as more of a network than a sort of forks in the road that you're going down on, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's more of a way of being that you can sort of see that complexity and hold it without necessarily have to make decisions or be ruled by it. I think it just takes that extra awareness and work to do that, would be my guess.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I think it's a really important point that it is more, maybe it's more exhausting to hold that multifaceted approach to ourselves and to life, you know. And of course, there's also something that, I'm not going to now moan about social media, but of course, that is one aspect I think that can get lost in social media interactions very quickly, right? That sort of the sort of multifaceted, yes, it's this and that rather than this or that.
Yeah, and I think there's sometimes no action, right, with the multiplicity. You kind of have to hold it. Whereas I think with choosing one or the other, then it produces an action plan.
Yeah.
Then you have things to do, especially for people who feel comfortable in doing things and clarity and motion. If you're on that camp, people, the doers, right? I think the multiplicity doesn't really give you straight answers. It's just you just hold it.
Yes.
And you then have to find your doing from somewhere else, you know?
Yeah. I love that. Yes. I never thought about it, actually. But, you know, to put it that bluntly, I think you're absolutely right. The multiplicity maybe doesn't quite encourage you to go into actions, you know. It sort of is more, the challenge is more to hold it, you know. Mm-hmm. And maybe that is more challenging because sometimes you just want to go into action, right? And you just want to, interesting.
Yeah, super interesting, super interesting. Okay, so we've kind of, and this kind of happens, like we kind of veered off towards like the struggles of being really sensitive. I'm curious, I'm sure with all these things, there's also like the superpowers, like the advantages. What would you say the advantages of being a highly sensitive man?
Something I do want to say before we answer about the advantages is that, or maybe it leads to that actually, is that it is important to also consider that high sensitivity correlates with mental health issues and signs of psychopathology. So when you're highly sensitive, you're also more likely to develop mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And then again, I think that's why this topic is really important for your listeners who are maybe in therapy or, you know, just, and they, if they feel, oh, or if someone feels, oh, that sort of describes myself, and maybe bring it up with your therapist, you know, it just might be an important piece in the puzzle, you know, not the most, you know, not the one that explains everything, but maybe just an important piece. And when it comes to the advantages or the positive aspects of being highly sensitive, I'm really glad you're asking because I do sometimes think again, you know, having this multiplicity in our conversation right now as well, you know, so it's not just, you know, a challenge to be highly sensitive because you might have issues with emotional regulation or overstimulation or self-confidence as a man, but also to talk about the positive aspects, you know, and to show that it's a bit of both and not just one thing or good, or it's not just good or it's not just bad, you know, in inverted commas. So I'm really glad you asked about the advantages. I think coming back to what I just said about therapy and the correlation with mental health issues, there are three studies at the moment who show that those individuals who are highly sensitive are also, they might be more vulnerable to develop certain mental health issues, but they also seem to benefit more from interventions. So there was, what comes to mind is a study that they did with teenagers in London, teenage girls in London, and they did a depression prevention program with them, and they could show that those teenagers who were highly sensitive and received the treatment were less likely to become depressed than those who were less sensitive. So what I find interesting about the concept is that it seems to go in both directions, and obviously more research is needed here, but it is not just the case that it makes you more vulnerable to develop certain issues, mental health issues. It also seems to be the case that you might benefit more from certain interventions or therapeutic treatments than people who are less sensitive. And I think in a way it makes sense if you quite sensitive to external influences, and if you really process what you experience quite deeply, it might, cognitively and emotionally, it might be the case that if you, you know, experience a really good match with your therapist, that you benefit from those interventions more. There's more research happening around that topic, something I'm actually doing at the moment, so hopefully we'll have more research coming up in the next few years. So that is one advantage, you know, in, if you want to call it advantage.
Something that I associate with high sensitivity is what I call porosity. It feels like there's a porosity to you, that things kind of come through and go through and kind of hit that core. So I can see how that can both cause mental health issues. And I actually wanted to ask a quite side note. It's like, what are some of the common ones? And we should just talk about this, because I think it's a really good point that you're making. But in the same way that, because porosity is, it's almost indiscriminate, right? With high sensitivity, the good things and the bad things come through. So I can see how prevention and support and treatment and healing modalities can also get through in the same way through that porosity and hit you. That kind of makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Exactly. I think that is exactly what you're saying, and that it goes in both directions. And I love that, you know, that word, you know, being porous, and that it goes, that it's an advantage and a challenge. It really depends on the situation. So you might struggle more in certain situations than people who are more thicker skinned, but you might benefit in other situations where maybe it is of benefit if you're quite thin skinned or if more penetrates you in a way, in terms of what comes from the outside. So I think that can be an advantage. And the other thing, I do generally feel this depth of processing, which is the most defining characteristic of, as I mentioned earlier, the DOES and the D, the depth of processing, is the most defining characteristic. And I think one positive aspect of being highly sensitive is how enriching it can be in terms of your life and how you live your life and how you interact with your life. And some people might quickly, you know, call it overthinking and give you 10,000 steps how you can still stop overthinking. But I'm always, again, a bit cautious about it, because sometimes I think it is really enjoyable to think about what is going on in your life and to feel a lot, you know, and to go through life not feeling numb or feeling detached, you know. And so I think it comes with a certain intensity, I would say. And I think we should celebrate this rather than just seeing it as something negative that we want to reduce or want to get rid of. Of course, if it's sort of overthinking and rumination in terms of being depressed, then of course that's a different story. But I mean, more in terms of, you know, just living life, being very engaged with life, you know, and I think that is a huge advantage. And the third aspect I would mention is showing quite high empathy. I mean, there is some research done on that. I think, again, we need more research on it, but it seems to be the case that high sensitive men also usually tend to be quite, show a lot of empathy. And again, surely that is a good thing and much needed nowadays. So these things, I would say, are advantages. And surely we want partners who are thoughtful and reflective and, you know, and emotional. I mean, I think that surely should be a positive thing.
True. And I love that with the second point of kind of celebrating the deep thinking and the deep sensations and the intensity, the thing that came up for me is like being sensitive enough to really fully experience awe, which I think is something that we don't experience that much, especially in the fast-paced lives that we live in with social media, there isn't a second to actually feel deeply awesome. Yes. We say awesome a lot, but like feeling that awe. And yeah. I think that the sensitivity gives you access to that feeling that just takes a bit, you know, it just takes a minute to sink in, to sort of feel that awe. And I think it's not something that's available to everyone.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. And I think that is something that we should celebrate, you know, that sense of awe, that sense of excitement, that sense of just feeling touched by something that you see or that you experience. Surely that is something extremely valuable in life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I know that your book is full of tools and skills and strategies for people to sort of be their highly sensitive ways, and not necessarily look at it as a pathology, but live a good life, a healthy life. Could you share like some of your top, maybe like the top three tools that you think are just good for people to know? And then for the rest, they can, you know, everybody can jump into the book. It's a great book that I recommend. But we'd love to leave people with, you know, some takeaways that they can really make use of. So what would be your like one or two pieces of advice?
Yeah, sure. I just want to quickly answer just because we briefly touched on something, I think the last question that was, what is high sensitivity associated with when it comes to mental health?
Yes.
Just absolutely. Because some of your listeners, you know, might have interest in that.
Absolutely.
And then I'll come back to the strategies.
Thank you.
So it is associated with increased risk of developing mental health issues like very common anxiety, depression, but also emotion regulation issues, as that I mentioned earlier. It is also associated with a lower subjective happiness and life satisfaction and a greater need for recovery. So these are all things it is related to. There are loads of other things it's related to as well, but those are psychosomatic issues as well. So quite a broad range of mental health issues.
I imagine addiction would be one of those as well. How does addiction show up in relation to highly sensitive people?
Yeah, super interesting. As far as I know, I'm not aware of a study done on that. I think it would be really interesting to look at addiction and high sensitivity because my suspicion is, but again, this is just me thinking about it, not based on any research that I could find, is that it would correlate. I can imagine that people who are highly sensitive might also more likely to self-regulate with alcohol or with drugs or with other drugs or, you know, whatever it is. But I can't think of a study that has done that. But maybe some of your listeners who want to do a PhD or research project on that might take this further. So in terms of strategies to improve your life quality, I basically, as I mentioned earlier, those three areas that have come up and that I described in the book, the first area was the overstimulation and dealing with intense feelings. The second one was problems with self-worth and self-acceptance, so this whole notion of not being manly enough. And the third was the lack of self-care, so leading a lifestyle that doesn't suit your temperament. I think any strategies or tools that approach these aspects are helpful. And it could be something in terms of dealing with overstimulation and emotional regulation. Any of the tools in the toolbook could be helpful. I mean, I mentioned many, but for example, to analyze your moments of overstimulation. So what are triggers? What are thoughts that come up when you're feeling overstimulated? How does your body feel? What is the emotion? What is the feeling that you're having? What is your tendency that you want to do when you feel overstimulated? So I think here it is, for example, quite important just to be aware of how it shows up in your daily life and to sit down and really think about and maybe even write it down how you experience it. And then, so that could be important. And then when it comes to emotional regulation skills, it could be very easy. First steps could be just to become better at naming your own feelings. I mean, it sounds super simple and easy, but I mean, I'm always amazed how difficult it actually is.
Simple, but not easy.
Yes, exactly. It sounds simple, but it's not easy, you know, to name, you know, what you're feeling and to create some distance to what you're feeling by just naming your feelings. And this the same to maybe recognize your triggers for what it is, you know, I feel because I'm so what is it that has that you've experienced that could lead to your that could have led to your feeling? I think mindfulness is important when it comes to emotion regulation. So there, all the mindfulness exercises, whether it's whether it is, you know, an informal one, just, you know, practicing and you walk down. Yesterday, for example, I went for a walk in the evening and I just at one point noticed I was very much in my head and just thinking. And then I thought, okay, let's become a bit more aware of what's actually going on around you. So I just paid attention for a moment to how my feet felt on the floor, how what I actually saw, what I actually could hear. So just paying attention to my senses. And that, you know, was a very informal way to practice mindfulness. But it could also be obviously meditation or more sitting on the cushion. Mindful breathing exercise would be a more formal way to practice it. I think to learn to normalize emotions could be helpful, to also become more self-compassionate, to also maybe think about the link between your feelings and your needs. So I think it often helps to understand our feelings better and our to regulate our feelings better when we actually make a link between, well, what is the need here? Why do I have this feeling once I've named it? And is there like a threat that a need is not fulfilled, or is a need frustrated that I have, an emotional need, or is a need fulfilled? So all these sort of steps, I think, could be very helpful when it comes to improving emotion regulation. And when it comes to the work around self-worth, I mean, again, it sounds always so, I mean, nothing new, but I think it is really about learning to identify where does this critical voice come from. You know, when you have very self-critical thoughts about you or your own sensitivity or about your own masculinity, who are those voices? Where do they come from? And then work, getting into the work around the self-critic, the inner self-critic. And when it comes to a lifestyle that might not quite suit or match your sensitive disposition, I think it depends on what the area of your life is, and really think about, is there any change I can make? And it could be, I remember that in London, I had a patient who was highly sensitive, and he, for example, we just worked on him leaving work and during the lunch break and just getting out for 45 minutes instead of sitting with his colleagues at the cafeteria or at the place where they used to work, where they used to eat during their work. And he found that it was really overstimulating. So we just worked on how could he increase downtime, how can he, so can he take the tube for one step, stop less, and can he walk the rest to work? Can he leave during the lunch break? I mean, little things like that. But he found that really quite helpful. So it depends a little bit on where the area is that you're struggling with, but making some lifestyle changes and just thinking about, okay, can I prioritize maybe certain things over the next few weeks? So those aspects, I would say. But basically, I think self-compassion, mindfulness, and learning to work with the inner critic and really improving your emotion regulation skills. That seems to me quite important. And to maybe also work around, okay, so what am I very proud of in my life? What am I happy about? What has been a good experience in my life? And how is this linked to my sensitivity and to my, you know, my sensitive temperament? Because I think often we tend to see it negatively, but just again to think about, well, how has this enriched my life, actually?
For sure, yeah. These are all great tools, and I agree with you with what you said earlier, that they are relevant to anybody who's either experiencing being highly sensitive or around people, loved ones, close, you know, friends, colleagues who are highly sensitive. I think it appeals, it's good for everyone. And I think with men specifically, there is that, I think it actually fits in with the self-compassion piece, maybe that additional layer of just making peace with it and not necessarily making it about the masculinity, about being a manly and the sort of the social narrative around that. I can imagine that might almost be like the first step, kind of separate the sensitivity from masculinity, and wrapped in that is the self-worth piece. Like I imagine that's probably where the work begins. With all the stuff,
Yes, and I think you know what you said is true in terms of also being aware that you're driving the social change in when it mm-hmm. comes to redefining masculinity by making that very narrow and highly problematic definition of masculinity mm-hmm. broader. And that is surely a good thing. I mean, I talk about this a lot in the first part of the book, you know, the how problematic are those norms, those internalized norms are. The more we have those traditional masculine norms internalized, the more likely we are to develop depression in life, for example. Mm-hmm. So by being a little bit more, by holding your head a little bit higher and being a little bit more self-confident about being highly sensitive as a man and going out there in the world, I think you change you're part of that change, and mm-hmm. you bring together that you can be masculine and sensitive. Mm-hmm. It's a multiplicity, you know, you can be this and that, you
right.
know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is, I think, a hugely important first step. Mm.
Yes, yes. I love that. I love that. What a great conversation, Tom. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To connect with Tom Falkenstein and check out his work, jump on Instagram at tom.falkenstein or visit his website, hsb-eu.com. You can find his book, The Highly Sensitive Man, on the Curious Fox Bookshop. We are curiousfoxes.com/bookshop. Check out the new episode drop email from Curious Fox in your inbox, where you'll find show notes, links mentioned on the show, along with other episode suggestions on identity and mental health that we think you'd love. If you're not getting those emails, you are missing out. So jump on our website, wearecuriousfoxes.com, and sign up to the newsletter. And of course, while you're there, check out blog posts and resources and reading list recommendations and more. You can weigh in on this topic and connect with other Foxy listeners on our Facebook group, fb.com/groups/curiousfox. If you're hearing this right now, we think you must like the podcast and find it valuable. So please share it with a friend. Also, quickly rate the show and leave a comment. And subscribe on Apple Podcasts or connect with the show wherever you're listening. This takes a few seconds of your time, but it has a huge impact on us. To support the show, join us on Patreon, where you can find mini episodes and podcast extras and over 50 videos from educator-led workshops. Go to patreon.com/wearecuriousfoxes. And let us know that you're listening by sharing a comment, story, or a question by emailing us or sending us a voice memo to listening@wearecuriousfoxes.com. This episode is produced by Effie Blue, with help from Yamur Erkishi. Our editor is Nina Pollock, who handles each episode with kindness and sensitivity. Our intro music is composed by Dev Saha. We are so grateful for their work, and we're grateful to you for listening. As always, stay curious, friends. Curious Fox Podcast is not and will never be the final word on any topic. We solely aim to encourage curiosity and provide a space for exploration through connection and story. We encourage you to listen with an open and curious mind, and we'll look forward to your feedback. Stay curious, friends.
Stay curious.
Stay curious.
Stay curious.
Stay curious.
Stay curious.
Stay curious. Stay curious.
Stay curious. Stay curious.